This is Paul Burnett interviewing Betty Gibbs for the Global Mining and Materials Research Project of the Business Series of the Oral History Center at the Bancroft Library. And we're here in Denver, Colorado at the Convention Center. It's February 18th, 2015, and this is Audio File 1. Welcome. I wanted to ask you a little bit, as I usually do, about your background, where you grew up, and your family.
Yeah, I grew up in Virginia, and I'm the oldest of 10 kids. I left home just as the eighth one was born, so I really don't know my youngest brothers very well, but I spent my childhood in a large family, mm-hmm. very active, and so forth. My father was a carpenter, and my mother was a court reporter, so when I was like 9 or 10, my mother started teaching me stenotype and typing, so I spent a lot of some of my childhood time typing for my typing court cases for my mother. But she also paid me, so by the time I graduated from high school, I had enough money for my first year in college.
Really?
Yeah, and it was my going away money. It's like, okay, I'm out of here.
You've done your time.
I did my time.
As a court stenographer.
Yeah, right. Well, I did transcribing, but I could read the notes.
Right, right. So. You had to be able to read shorthand.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, no, it was a machine shorthand.
Okay.
It's a stenotype. They have them in the Senate.
And right, and the little machine.
And little machine.
And tape that goes into it. Yeah,
right.
Great. And so that was your going away money to college.
Yeah.
Did you have an idea of what you wanted to study?
Well, and I didn't remember this until later, but I used to know a boy when I was about 9 or 10 years old, and he was very interested in geology, and he brought rocks around and all that kind of stuff. So it was kind of like a germinating sort of idea. And then when I was a senior in high school, I was reading this book about a mining engineer in the West, and I don't think I'd ever even heard of a mining engineer before. But I had been thinking of going into engineering because I had two uncles that were engineers. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to be a teacher, a housewife, or a secretary, or a nurse, which in the 50s, that was, you know, those were the things that women did.
That's right.
And so I said, no, I don't want to do any of that. I've already done that.
Yeah, you had been supplied with, quote, unquote, women's work by your mom.
Plenty.
Right.
Yeah. And I was like, no, I want to do something else.
Right. Were there other women role models that you had? I mean, your uncles were role models, but did you know of women who were professionals in the 50s?
No.
Nobody you knew?
No, it was just, this is what I want to do.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I think there were probably some teachers or something that sort of just tried to discourage me, but I think the thing that carried me through school and working all these years is that this is what I want to do, you know? Yeah. Why? You know, so, okay, you don't think maybe it's a good idea? Well, or, you know, what are you doing here? Women don't belong here.
Right.
It's like, yeah.
Right. So you just sort of took it in stride.
Yeah.
If there was some kind of hostility or opposition to your ideas. Yeah. So this would occur when you would tell people about your plans and they would have that kind of reaction?
Yes. Uh-huh. So I was not particularly encouraged.
Yeah.
There were a few people who said, oh, that's really sounds interesting. And and I remember in high school, somebody must have come to the classroom and I said I wanted to be a mining engineer, and they said, oh, you're going to go to the Colorado School of Mines? And I hadn't even thought about it at that point.
Right.
But when I finished high school, I did start at Virginia Tech.
Yeah.
And because I was in state in Virginia, so
you got the regular tuition.
Yeah, I got regular tuition, right.
Yeah, yeah.
And they had a mining engineering program.
Right.
Because I was also thinking about, well, maybe I can just go into geology, and then I looked in their book, oh, mining engineering, that's what I really want to do.
Okay.
And that includes a lot of geology.
Right, of course, of course.
So.
Do you remember what the tuition was in 1960?
It was 1960, and I had $1,000 in my bank account, and I spent it in the first year.
Mm-hmm. But that carried you through the year.
That carried me through the year, including room and board and tuition and books and all of that.
Wow. Times have changed.
Boy, you can't even go to school at all for $1,000
I think
anymore.
You can get two or three textbooks for that.
Yeah, good. Right. Exactly.
I mean, adjusted for inflation, it's a bit different. But,
yeah.
But so you went to Virginia Polytechnic.
Institute, in Blacksburg.
Okay. Yeah. And was that far from where you were?
I was from Northern Virginia, and that's down in Southwest Virginia, southwest of Roanoke.
Right.
Yeah, it was about 3 hours, but, you know, at that time, it's like, that's fine. Further I'm away from home, the better it is.
Yeah. Going away from college, the proverbial break.
Exactly. Right. And when I started at Virginia Tech, of course, I was the only woman in mining, mm-hmm. but there were a few other women engineers there because it was an engineering technological school.
Right.
And there were about 100 women there at that time.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
That's not insignificant in terms of
6,000 men, and I loved it.
Yes, well, that's good.
And it was also semi-military, so there was required ROTC for required military for the first 2 years.
Yeah. Oh, is that?
That's not Vietnam, Virginia Military Institute.
Right, different institute.
That's different. That's all military.
Right.
At Virginia Tech, they did have a required military for the first 2 years. For men.
Interesting. Right.
Women didn't have to do it then.
Right. And that was a big part in the 1950s. That was, I think, a lot of colleges had requirements for that, especially if they had any public money. I think that was...
Well, Virginia Tech is a land-grant college.
Yeah. That was part and parcel of mm-hmm. what you did in those days. It was different times.
Right. And there is an interesting story about my first few weeks at school.
Mm-hmm.
I went to a student, it wasn't SME then, it was AIME.
Mm-hmm.
I went to a student section meeting of AIME, and I walk in and they said, "Oh, great, you can be the secretary." And I said, "Okay, sure, why not?" You know, it's like, in a lot of ways, I'm kind of oblivious to some of the, the coding.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, okay, well, thanks for asking.
Yeah.
You know, that was kind of my attitude about it.
Right.
But
that protected you in a sense because you didn't. Yeah. It didn't bother you.
Yeah.
Or it didn't signify.
I didn't know.
Any
kind of a bias.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And then the department head walked in, and he says, "Well, you know, we can take you through the mining program. We can get you a degree in mining engineering, but you'll never be able to work as a mining engineer. But you can be an assistant to a president of a mining company."
Right.
And again, I went, you know, because I had every intention of working as a mining engineer, not being a glorified secretary.
Right. And often at those times that if there was any concession to having women in a professional training, their eye was either to something, as you said, affiliated, or motherhood, right? You could become a scientist and help your husband with his experiments.
Right.
Or you could inspire your sons to become scientists.
Yeah, right.
So
exactly.
Princeton did not allow women in graduate school until 1963.
Wow.
Those are the times.
Women were not allowed to work in mines in the 60s. And I think in Colorado, that didn't even change until the late 60s, early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
But my college career was kind of disjointed because I only had money for the first year.
Mm-hmm.
I worked in the summer. I had money for another quarter. And then I said, well, I don't have any more money. And my mother was... You know, they had a bunch of kids.
Yeah.
And so I said, okay, well, I'll quit. I quit school. I worked at Virginia Tech. I got a job there and doing secretarial work, which is fine. You know, I had the skills. And then after about 6 months or so, I started taking courses part-time. Because mm-hmm. if I took courses part-time, I didn't have to live in the dorm.
Right.
And I was independent and always been really pretty independent anyway, mm-hmm. I reckon.
Yeah.
And so I stayed there doing that until about 1964. And then I came out to Colorado because it was like, oh, I want to go to the Colorado School of Mines. And I have had an uncle that lived in Boulder, and a friend of mine was driving out that year. So I said, oh, I'd like to go along with you. So I came out to Colorado, worked here for a year to get in-state status, and then went back to school.
Great.
And worked during school to support myself.
And from that first time it was mentioned to you, Colorado School of Mines was kind of the Harvard of the mining
industry.
It was
kind of in the background.
Yeah,
there, yeah.
This is if you really want to do it, this is the
right.
place to do
yeah.
it.
Yeah, yeah.
And there
exactly.
were fantastic professors there as well.
Yeah, very good. School of Mines had professors then, and they still do, that have actual industry experience.
Yeah.
And it's a very strong, you know, it's a very strong culture of when you get out of school here, you can go to work directly in a company and be productive.
Yeah.
From day one.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's strong academically, but there's this, it has a, has its
a
own
practical
yeah.
side. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
And one of the other people I interviewed talked about, and this is a bit before your time, but talked about the kind of culture of the students and, you know, nobody put on any airs, and it was common for them to wear their, their engineering boots.
Uh-huh.
They wear them
right.
all the time.
Like, right.
Basically. This
yeah,
is
and you're always carrying your slide rule on your belt.
So how was that for, it sounds like a yeah. pretty masculine kind of culture.
It was. And again, it was like, I don't know how to say it exactly. It was like, oh, I want to do this. I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
And, you know, people, I think, kind of probably made fun of me for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually they realized that I was serious about it.
Yeah.
You know, that I wasn't just there to find a husband.
Right.
I was there to get a degree in mining engineering and work as a mining engineer.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So if you had conversations with people, I mean, did you establish friendships with classmates and things?
And yeah, so, and I still kind of keep up with a few of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I guess they just didn't know what to make of you.
That's true. That's true.
Right. And
yeah.
so it's a...
Yeah, they called women pigs. And, you know,
wow.
And I had this comment one time. You know, this guy kept looking at me, and he says, "You're feminine." I said, "Yeah." Mm-hmm. But I didn't know what he was talking about. Well, I sort of knew.
Yeah.
But it was like, you know, they expected women engineers to be these big, hulky, you know,
butch,
bulky
yeah.
sort of,
yeah.
Yeah, people. And yeah. I didn't fit their viewpoint of what a woman engineer ought to look like.
Right, yeah. right. They would assume
not
that
only
you...
that, I like to wear frilly blouses and and I love embroidery. And
wonderful. So.
In a way, I kind of did that deliberately, too.
You had a persona.
Yeah.
And that was a way to sort of kind of stake out some territory identity-wise, right? You can't pin
right.
me down.
Yeah.
I'm here to work. But
I don't need to be able to lift a jackleg by myself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So...
But with help and with somebody else, you know, there was another woman there that I got to be really good friends with, and mm-hmm. she and I took a lot of mining courses together, and she was a geologist and mm-hmm. also started taking mining courses and ended up getting a dual degree, one in geology and one in mining.
Mm-hmm.
And she and I took the school mining course together.
Mm-hmm.
And between the two of us, we could carry a jackleg down the drift.
How much does a jackleg weigh?
More than I do.
Wow. Wow.
Probably 75, 100 pounds.
Right.
And it's all dead weight, and it's a big, long thing
right.
with an arm.
Right, so there's the... So... It's unruly and awkward as well as being
yeah,
heavy.
Yeah, very much.
Right.
But she and I could carry it down the drift, and we would take it.
Right.
And there is an interesting story there, too, because in the first class, Sam Shaw was the professor, and we all were sitting outside the mine, and he says, well, it's really hard to get A's in this class. If you've worked in a mine for a couple of summers, you might get an A. Yeah, but otherwise, don't expect A's here.
Mm-hmm.
So Pat and I just, we loved it.
Yeah.
We just had such a good time. We tried everything. We did everything. I came up with an idea of, oh, I want to take pictures under, you know, take photos underground. Mm-hmm. So she and I did that. Well, we ended up getting A's. And, you know, we could hardly handle one of those jacklegs by ourselves, but mm-hmm. we got A's. But I think it was because of our enthusiasm.
Yeah.
And our willing to try everything, our willingness to try everything.
Yeah.
And, you know, just be part of the group.
Yeah, yeah. And you so. And you did everything with gusto, and you learned about the different aspects of the mine.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And it,
yeah.
was it a... I mean, we could go on the gender track for a while, you know, talking about how you're kind of entering the quote-unquote man's world, and there's that excitement, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
But more than that, just there's an excitement about this is the real thing.
Yeah, and it, I even hate to say, like, entering a man's world,
right.
because to me that isn't what it was at all.
Yeah.
It was like, wow, I really like this stuff. I'm yeah. really interested in it, and this is what I want to do.
Yeah, yeah.
And being male or female didn't seem to have anything to do with
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah. Even though there's all that
and,
coding.
And there were
there.
Certain reactions
yeah.
that came around that reflected that gender difference.
Mm-hmm.
But still, I think I was more focused on, let's do the work.
Yeah.
You know, hey, I want to learn about this. And,
yeah.
oh, this is cool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the... dust is blowing all over the place, and I'm trying to climb up a raise, and
yeah.
and you know, but I loved it.
And yeah. did it snap into focus the quote unquote book learning that you had been doing thus far? Like, did it did it make real some of the theoretical and mathematical stuff that you had been doing before?
Yeah, sort of in a way, but it was more like, well, the book learning is fine, but this is the real thing.
Yeah.
And it's, I don't know quite how to express it. It's like, you know, there's almost a disconnect between what's in the book and
yeah.
and the actual practice.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And that hooked you at that moment.
Oh,
you were,
yeah.
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 You were, if right. you were had any doubts before,
yeah.
this cemented your commitment to doing this.
Yeah, and Pat was also a great mentor because she and her husband had mining claims outside of Idaho Springs.
Oh, really?
So, and they had kids, and I had a little girl at that time, and they used to take us up to their claims, and Pat was always talking about, well, we've got these claims, and it has this kind of minerals in it, and we'd like to develop them, and so that you know, she probably did as much or more for me than anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And we were peers for sure,
but
it was like the interest.
Yeah.
It was the interest.
And enthusiasm yeah. and someone you could talk to about your enthusiasm for the work.
Yeah.
And that's also interesting too, that others from that period and before were that there were people you could, as an individual, you could have a mind claim, and there could be, you know, there were just groups of people.
Yeah.
Just a couple of people.
Yeah.
Who were working an old abandoned mine, which was I can't remember the name, the term for it, but you're basically kind of pulling out pillars
mm-hmm.
and continuing to work something that's long been abandoned or a new claim.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just hard to fathom. You know, when you think of mining, you just think of giant merged corporations today that have large mm-hmm. equipment and $1 billion of investment to develop a mine, permitting and all that. And here's this kind of wildcat approach to mining, and it's that. Can
right.
can you tell me about how that's done, or how that was done at the time, and what people did?
Well, there weren't so many regulations.
Yeah.
There certainly were some because, like in Colorado, there was a division of mines. And this was also very interesting because, of course, with Pat and Al having all of these mining claims, they knew the mine inspector very well. And the mine inspector was very supportive of both Pat and I in our studies and getting into the mining business. And he was the one who actually helped get the legislation passed so that women could work underground.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So in a small way, you two were kind of a part of that impetus, perhaps.
Yeah.
He may have been doing it anyway, right. but he saw that you were there.
And he saw that we were serious about it. I mean, we weren't, throwing our bras across
right.
the room or anything
right.
like that. We were just sort of matter-of-factly
doing
these things.
And
he was a good guy. He lived a long time.
Mm-hmm. And so you stayed in touch with him?
Yeah.
It's an interesting history that we could talk about that a lot, but just perhaps one more question: did anything you learn about that domain of the kind of call it amateur claims, but this kind of mm-hmm. DIY mining,
do it yourself?
Yeah, did that translate over to the what you learned in the mining school and what you did subsequently at all?
I think that what it did, as much as anything, was it sort of connected me with the real mining,
mm-hmm.
the reality of mining, that we dig rocks out of the mountain, and then we, there's something in them
right.
that we can get out that's worth something,
mm-hmm.
and it's sort of all started hanging together.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's something kind of mythic about it too, in the
the Tommy knockers and the
another person I talked to, he was reading kind of adventure stories as a kid, and mm-hmm. sort of there's something romantic about
oh,
mining
yeah.
at
right.
that level.
Oh yeah,
as part of part of stories and
well my high school story that I was reading was about a mining engineer who was going out to some claims, and there were prospectors, and he was proving that these claims were worth mining and all of that sort of stuff,
mm-hmm,
and so it's like the old time prospector image, and the guy who goes out and beats on the rock, and he doesn't necessarily know very much about the technology, but other than, I can pound this rock into small pieces and get some gold out of it.
Right.
And I just thought that I loved adventure stories when I was growing up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So there is that a little bit.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so you are at Colorado School of Mines in the mid 60s, 1966 until 1969.
69, yeah.
Yeah. Right. Those are heady times in the United States, and you're in Golden, Colorado at that time, so perhaps a bit removed from that, but it's on the radio, it's on the television. And
mm-hmm.
so what was it like? Is it just kind of in the background, or was it, because so much that's happening, and I'm thinking we just did the 50th anniversary of the free speech movement at Berkeley,
mm-hmm.
And that all that was going down in 1964, and Berkeley got its reputation for this kind of place where unrest
happens. Oh, yeah, well, I moved to Boulder in 1964, and that was kind of before the hippie movement, and
mm-hmm.
the hippie movement kind of started coming around about 67 or so. And,
mm-hmm.
And so it was like, I was kind of drawn to that,
mm-hmm.
but I still had this thing about, I want to get this degree.
Yeah.
So I was kind of like in Boulder, I was very conservative, and at the School of Mines, I was kind of a hippie.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Were you drawn to the music at all and that kind of thing?
Some,
yeah,
not so much the music, but mm-hmm. just kind of the counterculture thing,
mm-hmm.
Rebellion against the rigid ideas of things.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that resonated with you, obviously, because you were breaking those boundaries.
Yeah, because I'm a little strange, and I don't follow the norm.
Right,
and
right,
things
right.
like that.
Yeah.
So I think that was it.
And
because it wasn't the drug thing, you know.
No,
it's
no.
not very much into the drug thing.
Yeah,
so.
That comes to Colorado maybe a bit later.
Well, no, it was here then.
Was there?
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It was here. It was big. but another thing to me at that time was I said, I'm in school. Don't party during the week. Don't do anything. I don't drink during the week.
Yeah.
If I want to drink and have fun, I do it on the weekends.
Mm-hmm.
And I never really got into it. Drinking and things in a big way.
Right.
But I was also interested in folk dancing at the time, and that's a pretty clean living kind of group.
Yeah.
So I would come up to Boulder on Friday nights to go folk dancing, and that was, you know, sort of my life.
Yeah, yeah, and a social outlet that is not school.
Yeah.
And
right.
that was, it's important for a lot of people to have one thing that one
and,
group of
and
people.
And it wasn't talking with engineers; it was talking with all sorts of other people. And,
right. Right.
And I really loved the dancing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What kind of folk dancing?
International.
Okay.
You know, like Russian and Greek were some of my favorites.
Oh, wow.
Israeli and Scandinavian. And there were, Eastern European, mm-hmm. like Yugoslavian and Hungarian. And
wow, great.
Ukrainian and all sorts of other cool stuff like that.
Yeah, that's great.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're able to finish your BSc in mining engineering.
Well, it's actually engineer of mines degree.
An engineer of mines degree.
Yeah, because it required more hours than a bachelor's.
Okay, okay.
And we got a little silver diploma at the time.
Okay,
yeah.
Great.
So I have two silver diplomas because a couple of years later I went on to graduate school.
That's right.
I worked for Consol for coal and for 2 years and mm-hmm. then went to graduate school and got another one. So
as you had been told that what was good about Colorado School of Mines is that it's kind of a direct conduit to the workforce.
Yeah.
That happened for you.
Yeah.
As you finished your first degree,
right.
you were right in it.
Yeah, and I pretty much figured I could get a job.
Yeah.
And I did.
And did you apply to a posting, or were you, sometimes it's informal things, like a friend, you know, is working there.
No, they had recruiters come to
okay.
the school.
Right.
So I interviewed several places, and
okay.
And I walked into the interview with this guy from Consol. It was Consolidation Coal at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I impressed him because they offered me a job.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And some people were sort of put off. Mm-hmm. by a woman who was in engineering, but every now and then I would come across somebody who really sort of was, this is good.
Right, supportive.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
And so and they hired you. What was the nature of the first position?
I was hired in the exploration department at Consol, and they, I think, did not quite know what to do with me. And they put me on this project. It was building a geological database.
Right.
And this was sort of the beginning of my interest in computers.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm kind of lazy. I don't like to sit around punching a calculator. I'd rather put it in a computer and let the computer do the work.
Right, of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
So that was my first job. And it was kind of interesting because they had, I don't know, several people that had started working on this project, and
mm-hmm.
they really never quite got it off the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And I went in there and just started doing it.
Yeah.
And it's their database project is still going to this day. Of course, it's changed a lot.
I bet.
But somebody had to get in there and go through the old printed records and get them into punch cards.
Right, right. And this is core data and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, like drill hole data.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So that's a massive transition, and that happened. You know, that's something.
Yeah, this was like 1970.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so did you have to write the code for the data? Like, did you create the database?
I created the database. What I did was they had a computer department, and the computer department actually wrote the code. Mm-hmm. And they built the database system. They were working on programs to plot the drill logs, and they had a program that would do some contouring. Mm-hmm. But I supplied the data that went into that. So mm-hmm. what I did was I worked with them to develop some data forms, you know, because I knew what kind of data there was. So I developed the forms along, you know, kind of back and forth with the computer department.
Right.
And I think that probably what my initial contribution was is like, okay, here's the data. Here's what we want to do with it. Mm-hmm. And so my creative part was, how do I go from here to what we want to do with it, and what kind of information is needed from this original paper data mm-hmm. to satisfy what goes into the computer programs.
So, right. So it's an iterative process,
yeah.
back and forth a little bit.
And there were some other computer things going, you know, database things going on at the time. So mm-hmm. so I did some research around. I also visited a lot of the CONSOL mines and said, you know, this is what we're doing, and, you know, we're wanting to, you know, we're going to build this database, and, you know, how does this fit with what you are doing here?
Right. Presumably you have to sample over time, like, what kinds of records were being kept, because I imagine they change. They would add columns in particular areas.
Yeah, right. And, you know, like, there are certain, I think it was even the USGS at that time had some codes for, like, SH for shale, SS for sandstone, LS for limestone, and so forth. So I incorporated those and then started sitting down. I started writing stuff into these forms. Mm-hmm. And then that kind of got going. And then the head of the department hired a couple of people to just do the, you know, that straight coding, because that's really, that's a clerical thing. And,
yeah.
I guess he realized I had more to offer than right. than just, you know, writing stuff in little columns.
Well, that may have been part of it initially, because historically, computing as tabulation work had been quote women's work. Like, they had, you know,
right.
it had been
right.
it was a way for them to sort of translate in their heads what, you know, where does this person mm-hmm. fit? But coding and writing software and doing some of the higher end stuff that you were
right.
getting involved in was different.
And I did start writing some software at the time, mm-hmm. And I really had not studied any programming languages, but. Mm-hmm. A couple of guys in the computing department sort of took me under their wing and said, oh, you can do this, and we have this time-sharing system, and here's how you make a basic program. So I learned that part, and I was talking, the department head knew what I was doing.
Yeah.
So he showed me this big, long, you know, kind of accounting sheet that had all these calculations in it, and it was float sink calculations, something you do with coal,
right.
how much you do certain things to it and get rid of the bad stuff and keep the good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, there were probably maybe 15 or 20 columns of this thing, and he knew I was playing around with learning some programming, and he says, can you write a program for this? And I did it in a couple of hours.
Is that what they call a flow sheet? Is that
No, that's different.
Okay.
That's different.
Okay.
But he had it was like a what you would put into a spreadsheet now.
Right, right.
It was basically a spreadsheet on paper.
Right, right. And so you wrote the code for that.
I wrote the code for it in just a couple of hours. I mean, maybe an afternoon or something, and I took it into him, and he was oh. You know, and boy, was he impressed.
So
it was just, for me, it seemed like a little thing, but it was,
right.
you know, it was a transition point, I think.
You realized, and you got that kind of really positive feedback. It was so relatively simple for you, but they were amazed that you could do this. And was that an aptitude that you had been aware of?
No, not at all.
And what is that? How would you describe that aptitude? Organizational?
It's an ability to see what needs to be done, break it down into parts, and do it a bit at a time, and say, oh, let's see, I need to do this calculation, and how would I do that in BASIC, or how would I do that in Fortran?
Right.
And so it's like a, I don't know, development, I guess?
Yeah, development, and you're solving a puzzle.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Did you excel at mathematics? Is it something?
No.
No.
I wasn't all that good at math. I'm much better at text.
Huh.
And I love literature. I almost switched over to English, an English major at one point, but then I decided, well, no, I'll stay in engineering because I can always read. And I still read. I'm reading Chaucer again right now.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
Wonderful. So you've kept that interest.
Oh, yeah. I have a wide variety of interests.
Great. Well, we'll definitely need to fit that in there.
Sure.
As we go along, if you have interests that you want to talk about. I mean, I guess your hobbies evolved over time, or did they stay the same pretty much?
Well,
reading, of course.
Reading, I still love science fiction, so I've been doing that for 50 years.
Yeah. What do you love about science fiction?
It's exploring new avenues of things and, new different ways of looking at things. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, suppose there's this situation. How might it evolve if something happened? Like alternative histories sort of thing.
Right, counterfactual kind of things.
Or going to the stars and, so I think it really expands the mind.
It does. And it seems to be particularly, not to reference any stereotypes, but it does seem to be particularly resonant with engineers. That there's this, exactly the way you say, that you start from a slight alternative point and then you develop it with your imagination and you follow a trajectory.
Right now I'm reading some of the older science fiction because I have these books from like the 50s and 60s and they're projecting technologies, so it's very interesting to see what they thought might have happened and almost none of them had the vision of our computer technology, the level of computer technology that we have by now.
And overestimated others, the flying cars and all of that stuff.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Probably Arthur C. Clarke got the closest. So this is kind of off the topic,
Not at all. It's all part of it. But early on, you show this aptitude for working with computers. Do you remember how old the computer department at Consolidated was when you started? Roughly.
Let's see, that was in 1970.
Yeah.
It had probably been there for as much as 10 years.
Yeah. So when they got the first mainframes out.
Right. Well, they were doing business computing.
Right.
But the technical computing was probably only a couple years old at that time.
So ground floor.
Yeah, ground floor.
And it mushrooms into all kinds of different applications. As the 70s move on, as computer processing power evolves.
What really made the big difference was the introduction of the PCs.
Mm-hmm.
Because then we as engineers could have them on our desks.
Yeah.
And
you didn't have to share time.
Right. And we had a little computer there. It was very basic, but it was a start.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember at the beginnings, there were, it was like, boy, I'd really like to see a picture of this whole deposit, and I want to look at it from
dimensions,
different angles. And then I want to put a drift in there. And boy, we can do those things now. It is so exciting to me to have started from that point and see these things that I dreamed about then that are, you know, common today.
When did you first have the vision of a three-dimensional rotatable model for a mine?
Oh, that was probably in the 70s.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was working at Climax. There were two companies that were doing mining computing sort of things. And one of them is still around. That's Mintec. Mm-hmm. And they had a system, you know, it was still two-dimensional, but they had some basic graphics and not just, you know, like we used to get contour maps that had little numbers in them, you know, little numbers in a square, because it was like a printer sort of thing. So you print numbers, and that represents a contour.
Right.
And they had some graphics, and, you know, and some of it, some of the, it wasn't all my original ideas, because, you know, we would sit around in these sessions and kind of talk about it, you know, but, and the developers were saying, well, you know, yeah, this is what we'd really like to do. And gradually the graphics capabilities got better, and there were starting to be more companies that were developing mining software and incorporating these graphics that were being used for other things.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I think that the space program had a lot to do with improvement of the technology. So the mining software developers were adapting that technology into their work.
I'm curious about how mind maps prior to this represented the, like, how did they show the necessarily three-dimensional, because you really need that, you know?
Well, they didn't.
Yeah.
They were two-dimensional. They were two-dimensional maps. You'd have a series of maps, you know, like one for each level, say, in a mine. And then you, and I did drafting, a lot of drafting, too. And the maps would have, like, the outlines of, say, if it's a vein mine or vein deposit, then you would have the outlines of the drifts, and you would have numbers on there that represent the grade of the material, and you know, maybe the volume and things like that, and then you would write those on a sheet. So then you just kind of put it all together, but most of those pictures were right here.
There would be numbers or some kind of representation to signify the z-axis that would give you a sense of,
well, yeah, sort of.
Sort of, yeah, yeah. But not quite.
Yeah, right, because, you know, you could do cross-sections and you could do plans.
Right.
But it was very difficult to manually convert those into a three-dimensional drawing.
Right.
Now, what happened a lot during that time, and actually before that, years and years before that, was people would make models out of, like, plastic sheets. And, you know, they'd take the cross-sections that the geologists put together and then take these plastic sheets and put them in a frame. And in some of the mining museums, you can still see those.
Oh, that's phenomenal.
Yeah. In fact, I was out at a company in Utah a few years ago, and they had one of these three-dimensional models of their mining process.
Wow, that's extraordinary.
Yeah.
So there are all these kind of different efforts to sort of represent what is kind of this blind world underground, and that's so essential to understand the three-dimensional dimensions of this, right?
Right.
You can run
because
into another.
It is. It is three-dimensional. You're there in this little drift.
If you go too far, you can collapse a roof.
And you have to, and I think this is one thing that served me is pretty well, is that I have a good spatial sense. So I can visualize what it looks like in three dimensions. And, you know, it's almost like the technology is to the point where you can lose that ability if you don't exercise it.
This is a common, you know, we're just reflecting right now, but this is a common conversation that I've been having with a number of folks about the educational value and challenge of the incredible representational power of computing today, that mm-hmm. You know, the notion that we can drop a laptop into a classroom and students will learn because they're using quote-unquote technology, but they're not anywhere near the machine itself. They're not anywhere near the design, and mm-hmm. everything is just kind of pre-digested apps that they use, and they mm-hmm. they lose a sense. Do you think about that sometimes?
Oh yeah, right. And I have not been in those classrooms where they're teaching, because the schools now teach the mining students, and they use some of those programs to do the mining development. And they have like senior projects where they are given a set of data at the beginning of the year, and they have to develop the mine plan. You know, they have to do the ore body model and develop the mine plan and so forth. And a good friend of mine teaches one of those, or he's involved with one of those classes, and he says that the students, the students just do these things, and they, you know, they're kind of missing the reality of what they're doing. Mm-hmm. You know, they just, it's like having an electronic calculator and forgetting how to add a column of numbers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Are there any dangers with that, do you think?
Yeah, but when the students get out of school and they go to work in a mine, they get they kind of wake up.
So there's a little bit of on the job.
Yeah, right.
Reckoning, shall we say?
Right, right. And you know, I am so impressed with the students these days, because most of them are able to make that transition. Mm-hmm. And so they have the computer skills, and they're also learning the physical part mm-hmm. of, you know, how do we get this rock out of the ground and make something of it?
Right, right.
And it's so way cool. Mm-hmm. And there are more women, mm-hmm. which I think is absolutely fantastic. Mm-hmm. And these are women that, you know, you'd look at them, you think they were maybe some kind of model or something, you know.
So there's no necessary of the old stereotype of the, that you had to had to deal with.
Right.
And we should talk about that in more mm-hmm. detail. And let's go back.
Okay.
Again, so you've got a couple of years there where you're at Consolidated Coal, 1969 to 71, and then you go back. To school.
To graduate school.
Yeah. Can you talk about that? Was that a natural foregone conclusion that you needed to do?
Yeah. No. I just wanted to go a little bit further.
Yeah.
And I was living in Pittsburgh, and I wanted to come back to Colorado, and I thought that would be a good excuse. Mm-hmm. mm-hmm. It's no more complicated than that.
Yeah. Yeah,
and then it would give me more credentials.
Yes.
Out in the mining world.
Yeah, yeah, and it sounds like
some of both.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. You need both. It seems you don't get respect unless you've actually been in the mines,
right.
And you don't get respect unless you have the credentials, and you kind
right.
of need to dance between those two worlds.
Yeah.
Was there a thesis component of the
yes. Yes, yeah. I wrote a thesis on ventilation.
Right.
And that was something that I had worked on some at Consolidation Coal, mm-hmm. was a ventilation project. And that mm-hmm. was kind of in addition to the exploration database mm-hmm. thing that I was working on.
And in terms of next steps, did you think, were you always thinking, I want to be in the industry, I want to be in the mines?
Yeah. Yeah, and after graduate school, I said, I don't want another office job. I'm going to apply for jobs in mines. Mm-hmm. And when I got out of school, and this is kind of an interesting story also, because I was out of school. I had been so busy getting the degree that I hadn't really looked around for jobs. And I went to the school placement. The school had a placement office at that time. So I went over there and I said, you know, I'm out of money. I really need a job. What do you suggest? And at that time, Climax Molybdenum had an office like just across the road, across 6th Avenue from the school. So they said, so he says, oh, I'll just send you over to Bill Dessler and you can talk to him and see, you know, because I said, really want to work in a mine. I've got the desk stuff. I want to work in a mine, get the mining experience. And so I went over and I just walked in, no appointment, because my Volkswagen bus was just about to break down. Those were the days.
That's right. I don't think there's any scene in the early 70s that doesn't have a Volkswagen bus in it.
Right. Yeah, right. And so. I had one. So anyway, I walked in and, you know, told the secretary I would like to talk to Bill Dessler, and so-and-so at the School of Mines had sent me over. And so he must not have been terribly busy because he did let me in to talk to him. So I sat down and I could feel this hostility from him. And so I just sat there and just talked, and yeah, I've done this and I've done that, and I really want some in-mine experience and blah, blah, blah. And gradually I could see him kind of changing, and he was kind of warming up to the idea that, oh, well, maybe we can give this a try.
Yeah.
And that's how I got my job at Climax. And I was the first woman to work underground there.
Yeah. Wow.
And I started as an underground engineer. And it was very interesting because, well, first, they didn't have a place for women to change because I was the only woman that was working there. So they did find a separate dry for me. And then the first day, I remember, you know, they have these windows where the miners come up and they get their brass for the day to go, their underground ID. And you know, I put my diggers on and walked behind the windows there and was talking to some of the other engineers or the managers or shift bosses or something or other. All these guys kept looking through the window and saying, what are they looking at? Because I didn't think of myself as anything other than, oh, here I am going to work in a mine. I'm so excited about it, and I'm going to get this engineering job, and yeah, I know how to survey underground and stuff like that.
Was it the proverbial dropped jaws and stares kind of thing?
Yeah, very much. Yeah. And of course, they knew I was coming.
Yeah.
But
there was a cognitive dissonance for them. There's something here doesn't make sense.
they're
processing.
Yeah, right. And there was, I don't think they knew, again, well, I did have the job as an underground engineer, so I knew that I would be surveying, but I think that the company was not sure how it was going to work out. And I treated people underground just like I treated everybody, kind of like a little bit sarcastic, and you know, lay some shit on me, I'll lay it back, you know, stuff like that. So I got along.
So it's a one of the others I interviewed talked about respect down in the mine, and it has to be earned, and you can't just. You know, you're technically in a senior position, but you need buy-in from the miners and the people, and the mutual respect has to be established. Is that similar?
Very much. And they knew that I had the degrees, and they respected that, the miners did. And I think that the managers did and the other engineers did as well. And, you know, it was just like can she really do the job? You know, she's got the degrees. Can she really do the job? And I really could do the job. And I don't know. That was, I mean, there's more to it than that,
sure,
I suppose.
I bet, yeah. Yeah.
But
overall.
Overall, yeah. It went pretty well.
Yeah. I think it was just, for you, it was really focusing on the work.
Yeah.
And focusing on communicating your
right.
capabilities and being confident. It sounds like you didn't have much of a confidence problem.
Yeah, I do.
You did?
Yeah. But I don't let it show on the outside
right.
very much.
Right.
Yeah.
So you knew that you had to show no fear and go.
Not
in.
Exactly. I didn't know that. It was just that's how it was. Mm. It's like.
Yeah.
Well, you know, kind of in perspective, my mother was very disciplinarian mm-hmm. and, you know, really pretty harsh with us kids. Mm-hmm. And all of this seemed easy in comparison to that. And I certainly love my mother. And she did an amazing job of raising 10 kids.
Yeah.
You know? But she was tough.
Yeah.
And I think that probably carried me through an awful lot of stuff because it just didn't seem as bad. Yeah.
Take note, helicopter parents.
Yeah, all right.
So you didn't have deliberate strategies for doing it. You just knew you were going to do it because you really liked it.
Yeah, I loved it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I loved being underground. I loved doing the work. And, mm-hmm. you know, it was very exciting to me.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's surveying work. So you were gathering data about the...
Yeah, I carried the transit around underground and mm-hmm. set it up and, you know, did the work, mm-hmm. did the surveying.
Yeah.
Because you had to survey drifts, make sure they were staying straight.
Yeah, yeah. And so that was your first first position. And it wasn't anything to do with mine ventilation? It was later. It was,
I worked underground for about 6 months. Mm-hmm. And they were just starting the open pit there. And when I had interviewed up there, I had talked to a guy who was doing some computer programming for open pit design. Mm. And, you know, and we kind of connected, so he knew that I understood the computing part of it. Mm. So after about 6 months, he needed some help in the mine planning department. Mm-hmm. So I went to work in the mine planning department and worked there for a couple of years. And then I had one summer as a shift boss for an environmental crew, and then I worked in the ventilation department about the last year mm-hmm. that I was there. And
what work did a environmental engineer do in the mid-1970s?
Well, we planted trees. We did seeding of the tailings ponds.
Okay.
You know, our crew did
remediation, basically.
Yeah, remediation sort of things. And there wasn't a lot of testing of, there was maybe a little bit of water testing, but mm-hmm. not very much.
So it wasn't in response to federal regulations so much? Was it sort of
not
like,
so much. It,
no,
was,
it was kind of, this is how you do it, and part of the practice of the mines that has evolved over time.
Yeah, and there were some that were kind of starting because this was like the early 70s, so it was just getting started, but it wasn't, you didn't have to learn all of these convoluted contradictory regulations.
Some of the regulations were contradictory?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they still are. It's gotten worse.
can you tell me an example of a contradictory set of regulations for environmental remediation and cleaning?
Yeah, I'm not really up on that, but I know I've had experiences in Boulder County mm-hmm. with land use regulations there, and a contradictory regulation would be something like, well, we have to do wildfire mitigation, but you can't cut down your trees. You know, that sort of thing.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah.
All right. So you're working from 1973 to 1976 for Climax, or the Molybdenum Company, as a senior mining engineer.
Yeah.
I guess, did you start as a senior mining engineer? Or?
No, I started as an engineer.
Yeah. Underground.
I think it was 3-2-1.
Okay.
And then I moved up to a 2. But I don't think I was a senior mining engineer until I went to work for Gulf Mineral Resources.
Okay. And so how did that transition happen?
Well, I decided that I needed a change. And so I knew somebody. Oh, yeah, when I was in school, I used to go to local section, you know, AIME section meetings. Mm-hmm. So I had some contacts there. So I called up this one guy I knew, and I said, well, I'm thinking really about leaving Climax, or I might have seen him at a CMA conference or something. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about leaving Climax. Do you have any ideas? So he sent me to this guy at Gulf Mineral Resources, and pretty soon I had a job. So
the face-to-face networking of AIME and...
Right, and, you know, recommendations from somebody or knowing somebody, those have always been the best way to get jobs.
Yeah. I ask people, you know, so how did you find out about this job? A friend of mine.
Yeah,
so
right.
The answer always, oh, a friend of mine, met them at the meeting. And mm-hmm. and so it's a
great networking opportunity.
It is. Yeah. It does sound like it, even to this day. I mean,
it's hard
to believe now with like 8,000 people coming to a conference. That sounds a bit intimidating, but it's an opportunity for people, old friends to meet and old contacts to meet and new contacts to be developed. Mm-hmm. So at Gulf Mineral Resources, the title is Senior Mining Engineer now, mm-hmm. and Application Analyst.
Oh, well, what I was doing was, and that's another interesting story, mm-hmm. technological-wise, mm-hmm. because they had someone there who was doing, quote, operations research sort of stuff, which is like a big overall thing, and this first project I worked on there was on the Crow Indian Reservation, and you know, this operations research guy had done this computer work and said, oh, there's like 3 billion tons of coal under there. And the, I guess it was Mineral Resources Department or something. Mm-hmm. There were some people that were a little bit skeptical of that because, you know, it was just too much.
Yeah.
It was,
it
didn't
estimate.
Seem, yeah, it was high level sort of stuff. And those operations research stuff kind of started in the 60s.
And
that it was like, this is the answer to everything. And, you know, like, this can be mined. It has an overall stripping ratio of like 2 to 1, no problem, blah, blah, blah. We can mine 3 million tons of coal, or 3 billion tons of coal, and mm-hmm. and all that kind of stuff. And some of the people there were kind of skeptical. So I was kind of given the job of saying, well, is this realistic? And mm-hmm. and basically I discovered that it wasn't very realistic. And not only that, the Crows wanted a huge royalty, and it just would not have been economic. So that's kind of what moved me more into the computer resource calculation mm-hmm. thing. And we were doing it on... well, we did have mainframes, but the mainframes were in Pittsburgh, so it was a little bit awkward. But, I forgot. While I was in graduate school, I worked for Conoco Minerals doing, I wrote a program to do open pit design.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, like I calculated the resource and then did an open pit design. So I was doing some Fortran programming at that time to do that. So this kind of carried on into Gulf Minerals, and what I kind of got going there mm-hmm. was, I was having to fight this perception that, oh, we can't do things on computer.
Right.
You know, it doesn't really answer everything, but.
Can you talk a little bit about resistance to computing
in
the mining industry?
Yeah.
Where does that come from, and what were their fears? And was there anything justified in there? Had they had bad experiences with?
Some did, yeah. And some of it was from people who were saying, "Oh, we can do everything. We
right.
can solve all your problems with this computer program."
Right.
And so they got, they got kind of a bad taste in their mouth about computing. So when I moved into Gulf Minerals, they had a pretty bad taste, and I kept saying, "Oh, we can do these things on computer. There's this company, Mintech, that has these programs, and you know, Climax or Amex at that time was starting to use them, and you know, we can do it." And they would say, "Yeah, but you know, there's this, the geological part is more of an art, and you know, the geologist does this design. We can't reproduce that on computer." And and so kind of what I ended up doing is saying, "No, you can't reproduce that on computer, but you can take what they're doing and use the computer to do a lot of the calculations that people used to have to sit around with a little calculator or with their slide rules and do those calculations."
Yeah.
"But we can do that part on the computer, and the geologist needs to interface. You know, the geologist needs to do their work, mm-hmm. and we can take that and put it into a program." And this is exactly what's happening these days.
Mm-hmm.
But back then, you know, there was, a computer can't do a contour map that we could accept.
Right.
And there's certainly, and there is still, you know, some caution about that.
Yeah.
That just because you can do all of these fancy stuff with a computer doesn't mean it's has anything to do with reality.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's kind of hard for these kids, I think, because, you know, they tend to get overly dependent on what the computer is doing.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, it's like, and it was back, same thing back then, too. It's like, well, if the computer puts it out, it must be the right thing.
Right,
but
right.
There were still a lot of skeptics at that time that said, "No, just because the computer drew it, or, you know, I don't even trust what the computer does."
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But now it's, you know, now it's sort of the other way. People tend to kind of think, "Oh, the computer did it, that must be right."
It's an automatic.
And it's hard to say, maybe so, maybe not.
Right.
So this is some of the training that I've done with a friend of mine, and we've done quite a bit of training on what's reality about contouring, and you know, what kind of trouble can you get into if you don't do things right.
Right.
You know?
In the term in science studies is technological progressivism.
Mm.
It's a blind faith
mm-hmm.
in technology, just assuming that, oh yeah, the computer's, it's going to be better because it's mm-hmm. high technology, it will result in a better outcome, without any engagement in, you know, well, part of it might be better, but it might be worse in some respects, and we still need to tweak it, and
mm-hmm.
We still need to do certain kinds of real-time or real interface with testing the actual, you know, the actual mine site.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's a challenge in education these days,
right?
And you know, it's critical thinking. So,
mm-hmm. And it's something that you can only really learn by experience.
Yeah,
yeah.
You can try and teach by examples, but unless they encounter it, it's just difficult.
Right.
So, and I was going back to your first example of the open pit. Design,
mm-hmm.
your first one.
Mm-hmm.
Were you were starting with the measured or expected deposit?
With drill hole data. Starting with drill hole data.
And then, and so you'd have a certain number of variables in your program that you could input, and you'd input these variables. So it was to kind of semi-automate some of the process of pit design?
Yeah.
Okay.
Something like that.
Okay. I'm sure it's more complicated than that, but I was just trying to get a sense of what you could do with what Fortran programming was useful for mm-hmm. at that time.
At that time, I was writing was a program to do inverse distance estimation for determining what OR grade would be in a particular block.
Okay.
And then it was the Lurch-Grossman concept, and it was a pit design sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And they were working on it at the Bureau of Mines at that time. Mm. So I kind of researched that and tried to understand it. It's a very kind of difficult thing, but eventually there were some people that have developed some real nice software based on that, on those techniques.
Principles and techniques.
But at that time it was a two-dimensional thing, and what's optimal in one cross section can be very different from what's optimal in the next cross section. So that was the sort of thing we were struggling with mm-hmm. then. Mm-hmm. And now, and then things were done two-dimensionally then. Mm-hmm. Now the estimations are done three-dimensionally.
Right.
So I was in the two-dimensional world at that time, wishing for a three-dimensional world.
people were calling it into being at that point, really wishing for it. And as soon as the processing power was there,
I could see it. Yeah. I could see it happening, but it wasn't there yet.
Right. Yeah. Right. And in so many fields, in other fields of biology, being able to image a molecule, so you can see the transition.
MRIs. Yeah. MRI is a very good example, because those turn into like three-dimensional pictures for doctors.
Right, right. And and so that imaging capability of seeing something in three dimensions and being able to rotate it sounds like a tremendous tool for the mining mm-hmm. industry as it begins to come online in we'll talk our way through it as we migrate our way through your career here.
Yeah, because we've been kind of jumping around.
We have. And so you were doing feasibility studies for coal and uranium properties. That was part of the time at Gulf Mineral Resources.
Yeah, right. Hmm. I did some work in coal. We were doing more work in uranium mm-hmm. at that time, mm-hmm. and they had a project down in Texas called Conquista, and I worked on that a little bit. Mm. I did some work on that with a geologist who I still know. He lives up in Casper, and we've worked on uranium projects in the last few years.
Oh, cool!
As consultants.
Right. So you've kind of come back to that area a little bit.
Yeah. You never really that and others. Mm-hmm. I've mm-hmm. just done a lot of different commodities at this point. Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that jumped out at me during this period, this is in the late 70s, early 80s, you developed software for economic risk and sensitivity analysis.
Risk analysis, yes, right.
Can you talk mm-hmm. a little bit about that and how that work was done? Do we have 10 hours?
Well, that was kind of like a project sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And I was just interested in doing something with that because it's a sort of a statistical thing.
Yeah.
And you can develop graphs, essentially graphs. Mm-hmm. Here's a particular event.
Right.
And how do we describe that mathematically?
Right.
So once you describe that mathematically, that fits in here. We design, define something else mathematically, that fits in there. So, and then all of that fits into a cash flow. Mm-hmm. So what the risk analysis does is that you go through it and basically you're saying in this particular iteration, I'm going to pick a random number that represents a point on this either discrete or continuous graph, mm-hmm. and then run it based on that. And you run 1,000 or 2,000 or 10,000 of those, and you start getting a feel for you know, where your sensitivity points are.
Right, right. And get a sense of a range or thresholds for certain kinds of activities.
Yeah. And there's, you know, the simple thing is, well, let's see how it works at 0% return.
Right.
-5, -5, -10, +10. But this is a lot more, you know, you do more calculations inside.
Right, right. And you can see that processing power is important. Processing power is important.
Oh, when I took an economic analysis course, and when I took it, I didn't really have a computer, so I did all the calculations on big accounting sheet, and then I learned how to use Excel, and it was like, oh wow, this is fantastic. Actually, it wasn't Excel at the time; it was Quattro Pro, I think.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Great.
And it was like, oh wow, I love this. You know, I'd spend a whole afternoon doing one, and here I could do 10 in 10 minutes. Yeah.
Well, this is this dovetails into the next phase here, because you return, if I'm correct, you return to the Colorado School of Mines in the early 80s. Is that right?
Oh, I taught there.
Yeah.
Yeah, for three and a half years.
You were an assistant professor at the School of Mines.
Yeah.
So can you talk about that transition? And it's a brief period, so it's something you tried for a while and then moved out of it.
Well, I got tired of working for Gulf Mineral Resources also.
Okay.
And
where was that based? Did you have to move?
Or I was in Denver.
Okay.
Yeah. I said, well, you know, I'd really like to do some consulting work, but I didn't quite know how to get started. So I thought, you know, I considered going to teach, because the School of Mines, they encourage professors to do consulting work. So I thought, well, that would be a good transition. Mm-hmm. And I taught there, but I also found out that that wasn't really my best thing either. So then, but during that time, I started in the software evaluation thing, because that was when the early 80s was when these companies were really starting to expand, and you know, PCs were starting to take off.
Right.
People, they were lower priced. You could do stuff on your desktop that required big, huge computer installations before that.
Mm-hmm.
And now engineers could sit at their desks and do some of this work there, and the market just expanded like crazy there in the early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And there was also a group called Computer-Oriented Geological Society that started up about that time that I was involved in. And it was, you know, a bunch of people who, you know, started with a lot of geologists, and they had these PCs, and there wasn't any geological software, so they were developing their own, and so that was kind of part of that that group also, and I did some software development there too, but again, I realized that I'm not the best programmer in the world. But I really liked using the programs, so that kind of worked into, you know, just researching the software that was out there, evaluating it. What's the real thing? You know, what's happening here, and what are all these programs that people are starting to use? So I started a newsletter and a software directory, and wrote articles, and you know, there were some, you know, the interest in computing for geology and mining was getting more mainstream, a little bit more mainstream. But there weren't very many people writing about it, and there weren't very many people consolidating the information.
Right. I mean, so, it seems like it was in the history of computing in like the late 70s and early 80s, it's these very, very kind of some closed communities of the developers themselves, and they were very, very tightly connected. But you were interested in kind of reaching, It sounds like from the lists of papers you were doing in the mid-80s, that you were almost like a bit of a proselytizer, is that?
Yeah. As I said, hey guys, here's some cool software and you can do these things with it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what are you still using a hand calculator for?
Right. And during this time as well, during the time that you were, I'm just interpreting this data, during the time that you were at the an assistant professor at the Colorado School of Mines, you did some postgraduate coursework in mineral economics.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about the discipline of mineral economics? How is mineral economics different from mainstream economics? Is it just that it's focused on the mining industry, or there's some differences?
Well, there are differences, yeah. And it does focus more on commodities. Mm-hmm. In mineral economics, you take the basic, micro, macro economics. But when you get through the basics, then you start in specific courses. Like one of the most well-known courses is Frank Sturmohl's. I can't remember what it's called now, but it's basically an economics course that teaches you how to evaluate mineral properties. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of examples, because mineral properties are not easy to evaluate, because it's all virtual until you actually dig it, and by the time you dig it, it's done, and then it's gone.
Right.
So, and there are other, they use the same basic economic techniques, mm-hmm. the same cash flow kind of things, but you have to be aware of the risks and the uncertainties. Mm-hmm. I can say, well, I think this deposit has this particular grade, but and if you don't realize that, it may be there and it may not be, then people have gotten in a lot of trouble.
I bet. Yeah. And I guess part of that is also risk analysis. You're trying to develop a range of estimates. It could be at the lowest end, the ore body could be this, and at the highest end, it could be this.
And the probabilities.
Right.
You work with probabilities. That's geostatistics is very good mm-hmm. with that. So you're saying, that I can, doing these techniques, I can have, and with the data that I have, I can have this degree of confidence that this is probably pretty close to what it really is.
Right.
And then when you actually get into the mining of it, then you go back and compare what you did to, you reconcile with the, what you're actually mining with your original model.
Right.
And then you can adjust your model in that same mine, so you can adjust your model so that you get, pretty good. So you get closer.
Right. Yeah. It's adjusted in an iterative process, and it's like it's like project management. It sounds like that you have your estimated costs as you start, and then as you go along, you make
adjustments.
You have
to adjust.
And you have to And so the taking that coursework, you had questions in your mind that derive from your initial efforts to model mines and model new mines. Is that what you were thinking? Or were you thinking ahead to wanting to consult and you want to have credentials in that area?
Right. Some of both, yeah.
And so
I wanted the credentials because I thought that this would give me some skills to add to my resume to get jobs.
Mm-hmm. And was mineral economics at Colorado School of Mines, was that fairly new as a discipline?
Yeah.
Or had it been around
for a while?
It was
pretty new.
Yeah.
Back then.
And so this is, while you're an assistant professor at the School of Mines, you take this graduate course.
I could take one course a semester for no charge.
That's the other motivation.
Yeah, right. and I was interested in it, and I've done a little bit of work as a consultant on mineral commodities and supply demand sort of things.
It sounds like it helped.
Yeah,
it kind of fit part of your repertoire.
right.
of techniques. You're interested yeah. in estimation, assessment, ongoing assessment, planning.
Yeah.
And that's, it seems to be all part of that.
Right, right. And I'm interested in a lot of different things, mm-hmm. so I didn't particularly want to go and, you know, do mind planning at a single mine for the next 30 years.
Right,
know?
Right.
I like doing different things and having different challenges.
Well, speaking of that, that's a good segue.
Uh-huh.
this is right around the time of the genesis of Gibbs Associates.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about how that came about? And obviously, you wanted to strike out on your own. What were the ingredients that made that an option for you?
Well, part of it was I was out there talking to people about computer applications, and I was getting very familiar with the software that was available, and I was starting to write articles about that time.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to be known as the person to go to. The vendors knew me because they said,
right.
you know, go see Betty. You know, you've got a mining product. Go see Betty, and she'll write about your stuff. And,
mm-hmm.
and so then that led into some consulting jobs for companies like, you know, I've done like database cleanups for some companies where
mm-hmm.
where they just had a bunch of data and they didn't know quite what to do with it, but they needed to get it into some kind of digital format. So
mm-hmm.
I've done some of that, and I did some old uranium data. You
mm-hmm.
know, like the uranium data had been sitting around for 30 years in these old magnetic tapes. So how do you retrieve that? Because that's thousands of drill holes,
yeah.
and you know it's expensive to do the drilling and. If we can retrieve them from those old tapes, then
mm-hmm.
that saves us a lot.
So you had to mount those on an old mainframe?
Yeah. Well, you had to go around finding somebody who had one of those old tape drives.
Right, right.
And then be able to interpret the data that was on them because, you know, IBM had its format, Control Data had its format, and so forth. So
mm-hmm.
so I didn't do all of it myself, but I found people who had the skills
right,
to
right.
do that, and then I would, you know, interpret the data because I knew what the data should look like and what it meant.
Mm-hmm.
These computer guys had no clue, but
right.
they could read it
yeah.
and give it to me in a ASCII format, so
yeah.
I could do something with it.
Yeah.
And then I did a lot of evaluation of software for companies because the company would say, well, you know, we want to put in one of these packages, and not very many companies had them at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Some did, for sure, but a company would say, you know, I want to know what's the right package because there were like five or six different ones. And
right.
so I would go to the company and look at what they were doing and say, oh, okay, well, let's see. I think, you know, this package A, B, and C would be, you know, would probably be suitable, and
mm-hmm.
then I would do like a comparison of the capabilities,
yeah.
and I would talk to the users, and of course I understood how things work, so that helped a lot.
Mm-hmm. It's an enormous. I mean, you fit. You fulfilled an enormous role in mining at that time because.
Mm-hmm.
Mining has this problem. You explained that there was 30-year-old uranium data on these
mm-hmm.
dusty old tapes, and that's part of the. And I'm guessing here, but that's part of the problem of the industry is that there'll be exploration and development. It then will then lie dormant because the funding doesn't come together.
Right.
The company gets sold. There's a merger, or there are all these kinds of reasons, and the market collapses.
And then the technology changes.
And then the technology changes in the interim.
Right, and they don't keep up with transferring that data into other formats.
No, because it can
because there's no money for it.
Right, or there's no institution
right.
anymore. It's
yeah.
They have these properties, and it's on the books, but they're not. There's no institutional. The institutional memory is only
it's
as
gone.
Alive
yeah, right.
as the management that says this needs to be constantly updated and constantly translated.
Right. Yeah, because they didn't have that. You know, that they took these tapes and old printouts and just threw them in a warehouse somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. Did you ever have any problems with damaged tapes?
Yeah.
Lost tapes?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There were some. A couple of the projects I worked on were pretty good.
Yeah.
Because the magnetic media, of course, kind of deteriorates after a while.
It does.
And the ones in that project were pretty good, and we were able to get the data captured.
Mm-hmm.
But then I worked on another one, and the tapes were okay, but we couldn't decipher the data. Because you have to know something about the format. And,
right.
And if the guys who make the tapes don't put something on there about what the format looks like, who knows?
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. So. In some ways, those problems don't go away,
mm-hmm.
right? So you're in business
for yeah,
the
right.
foreseeable future.
Right. And then, you know, I have worked on some projects where they had some stuff on computer, but then they had all of these old drill holes that were still just on paper.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but now there are pretty easy ways to digitize that information and get it into a digital format.
Mm-hmm. Were they in punch card formats? They were actually written by hand.
No, these were drawings.
Oh, I see.
And handwritten logs.
Wow. Wow.
And there are still companies that have that.
That's astonishing. When you think of some of these.
That's a small company.
Yeah.
You know, small companies especially, they still do, you know, they do a lot of things by hand.
Mm-hmm. And properties are sometimes 100 years old.
Yeah.
And have been worked and reworked and
right.
abandoned and taken
yep.
up again.
Yep.
And it's a real challenge for the mining mm-hmm. Mining companies, large and small, to maintain the knowledge of what they have.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if I can confirm this at all. I heard a rumor that the archives and records of Anaconda Copper, which is one of the largest copper companies in the world, are in somebody's basement.
Some of them are, yeah. Some of them are also at the University of Wyoming in Laramie, because
mm-hmm.
I have dug into those.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this is actually relevant to the work that you've
done.
Oh,
yeah. Right. And definitely some are still in somebody's basement. And I know that some of these uranium properties are still in people's basements. Yeah.
Okay. So there's work to be done, in other words.
Oh, yeah.
Right. So in 1984, Gibbs Associates starts. Mm-hmm. Who are the associates?
Me.
Okay.
And whoever else I can get to
yeah.
work with me,
yeah.
a guy named Steve Krajewski is a person that he and I started out in like the early 80s, and I met him through the Computer-Oriented Geological Society, COGS, and you know, we did some workshops together and we've maintained a good friendship over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And we still occasionally will do something together.
Right, right. And processing power really takes off at this time.
It's wonderful.
And so, you know, now I think we can venture into talking about 3D modeling and that kind of stuff. So when
mm-hmm.
does that really become a reality for computing in the industry?
Well, it was kind of gradual. And probably mid-80s to mid-90s
yeah.
Is when the vendors were really starting to, you know, really working on developing those 3D capabilities.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it's really only in the past 10 years where it's just mushroomed completely.
Yeah.
So that, you know, like now I have a program that I spent probably, I don't know, $15,000 on,
mm-hmm.
which does more than what programs in the early 80s would do that would cost $50,000 or $100,000.
Mm-hmm. So some of the early mm-hmm. software programs were that expensive?
Oh, yeah. And a couple of them still are.
Right. So would you, sell the car to get one of these, or would you partner with others to share the cost of the software, to share the cost of a license, or how would you, those are expensive for single operation.
Yeah. Things are a little different now because you can actually almost rent them by the hour.
Yeah.
But back then, when I worked on that kind of software, I worked on the company's programs because they could afford to buy them.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So you could use them.
I was well known enough in the vendors that, I could get demo versions and stuff like that.
Right.
The people at Rockware they always give me a license. Almost, I say, "Hey, Molly, I got this project, and I'd be glad to pay for the software." "Oh no, you don't owe me anything for the software." And then they give me a license.
Oh, nice.
And
and that company is called
Rockware.
Where?
Yeah, out in Golden.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Like in, computer software for rocks.
Yeah.
And they've always been, the low-cost, inexpensive geological software. Mm-hmm. They also started out in the early 80s with the PCs, and Jim Reed was one of the founders of the COGS group mm-hmm. also. And they've developed, they were actually a fairly early adopter of three-dimensional things. Mm-hmm. And again, they, three-dimensional images, and they got software, some graphical software, and incorporated into their system.
Did they have to use, early 90s, this is like Seagraph machines, did they have to use special PCs that were souped up for this kind of work?
I don't remember exactly when it changed, but as mm-hmm. PCs got more capable, then early on, you had to have a souped-up computer.
Yeah.
For that, but then the technology kept progressing, mm. and you don't have to have a special computer anymore.
Yeah,
you do. It is good to have more memory and.
Yeah.
Good graphics capabilities, but now things work on just about any graphics thing, and we have 8 gigabytes and a little flash drive, and almost a terabyte of memory, and I don't remember the exact dates, but it was in the 90s probably that the personal computing power got strong enough to actually run some of the bigger programs.
Mm-hmm. And so you'd be in a position to know the kind of geography for mining software in the United States and maybe in the world.
In the world, it's a worldwide thing.
It's a worldwide thing. So was Denver a major epicenter for this kind of thing? Or was it stuff that was being adapted from Silicon Valley or MIT? Was it...
No, not so much.
Yeah.
The people that were developing the software were writing stuff from scratch.
Yeah.
Like the Mintec people, they're based in Tucson. There were several companies in Denver that were developing stuff, a couple in Canada mm-hmm. and Australia.
Mm.
And there's one based out of England.
Right.
So there were these kind of centers of mining software development.
Yeah. So two large mining states in the United States produced this, and two large mining countries, Canada and
Australia.
Yeah. And England.
And then England has, they're all over.
right.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. So so you continue to do... data rescue and conversion, that was something you've been doing from
mm-hmm.
the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And or reserves.
Yeah. In other words, the calculating or determining the ore body models.
Right. Well, geological modeling.
Geological modeling.
And GIS mapping, so.
Yeah, I've dabbled in that
okay.
for a while.
Uh-huh.
And it has some use in the mining industry, mm-hmm. but it's very useful for environmental stuff.
Yeah.
Because you can basically build layers of information.
Right.
So you'd have a wildlife layer, you'd have a plant layer, you'd have a water layer, and so forth.
Right.
And
it's discrete, and you can layer them on top
yeah,
of each other.
Yeah, right. And there are some mining companies that use GIS.
Mm.
So I dabbled in that. So I've dabbled in this, dabbled in that.
Since 2006, maybe misinterpreting this, maybe just in 2006, but it looks like since 2006, you've been also consulting for a consulting company?
Yeah, well, with Barry Dolbear.
Yeah.
And I'm an associate, a senior associate mm-hmm. with them. And their model is they have a few people that are salaried,
yeah.
and then they hire associates depending on the job. So,
right.
So I get a job from them, and they say, okay, you're going to team with these three or four other people, mm-hmm. and you go out to these properties, and we do different things, you
yeah.
know, like, yeah. Like every year we do an audit of a particular mine.
Right.
And so we go up, and I'm the ore reserves person, and so I kind of look at what they're doing that way, and I get also the nice thing about that is I also get to hear all the rest of it too.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very broad-based sort of thing. But I'm working with teams
yeah.
almost always.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It sounds like what motivates you in part is that you need things to be different.
Yeah.
You need to change up.
Yeah.
You don't like routine. Right. And consulting gives you that, you know, you can come in, there's a big mess somewhere, and you can clean it up and move on to the next thing.
Yeah. I've done that a few times. Yeah, I go in and I, oh, this is awful, you know. You can't use this data. You're using 5 different names for the same thing. And
mm-hmm.
yeah,
mm-hmm.
so
a lot of the,
that
you
sort
know,
of thing.
The discipline of protocols, it's mm-hmm. something my...
Well, yeah, but like, in this 100-year-old mine that I did some work for, well, they changed how they did things over the years.
Yeah.
And they didn't go back and really clean things up.
Yeah, that requires some sleuthing. You have to sort of identify at what point it changes. You have to go through you sample, I imagine, at different years, and then you say, okay, now it's different. And you have to go back and find when it changed and then incorporate that
yeah,
parameter into the series.
Sort of,
yeah.
you know, but... When I put this stuff in a database, then it's pretty simple. You just kind of sort on the formation name and
yeah.
okay, what's this one, what's that one, and sometimes they know and sometimes they don't.
Right.
And so sometimes you have to kind of just put things as a big question mark and
right.
and oh, this is all seam 3.
Right.
Okay, but here's another way that they said the same thing.
Right.
And so sometimes it's just, you know, doing visual checks because mm-hmm. you can't always write routines to find things. If mm-hmm. you don't know what you're looking for, you can't write a routine to find it.
Right, right. Yeah. And so that's what people call cleaning
yeah.
the data. You have
right.
to clean up the data so that it's
yeah.
consistent.
And I have an eye for it.
Yeah.
You know, because I can take a sheet like this. If there's an error anywhere, I go right to it.
You just kind of scan almost with peripheral vision?
No, I don't know what I do, but I really don't.
Right, right.
But and this even happened with a lawyer one time. And he was just flabbergasted because, you know, and I hadn't looked at it for more than a couple minutes. And said, oh, there's a spelling error there.
Right.
Typo.
You see something that just doesn't fit.
Yeah.
And it's
maybe
like
that's because I do so much reading.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not something. That's not something that I control.
Right. Right. It's just
it
part
just
of your.
Happens.
Yeah. It's part of the repertoire yeah. that you've developed from training. You've trained your mind. You've had an aptitude, mm-hmm. I'm sure, and then you've trained your mind to work in certain ways. And so at this point, I think certain stuff is automatic.
Right, but when you say train my mind, I didn't do it consciously.
No, sure.
I didn't sit down and say, okay, I'm going to learn how to do this.
Yeah.
It's like it just developed.
Yeah, yeah. Well, in the course of doing work, mm-hmm. I think, you know, you've got a time constraint, you're working, you know, late on something, and you're just hitting that activity over mm-hmm. and over again, your brain adapts to that activity. And before you know it, it's kind of automatic, and
yeah,
you excel at that just because of repetition and effort.
Just happened.
There you go.
Yeah. Sometimes I think my whole life just happened.
Yeah, people have made references to fate and things mm-hmm. like that, but there's other pieces to your career. There's service. You've done service to the profession, and you've done other kinds of service as well. Can you talk a little bit about the United Nations stuff?
Oh, right. Yeah. Those were fun jobs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what happened there?
Well, I knew this guy, and I had known him because he was part of a company in Canada that they didn't develop software, but they did consulting using software or something. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I knew him from all of this activity with the evaluation stuff. Mm-hmm. So he went to work for the United Nations. And then he said he was working on getting computer applications in various countries around the world, in mm-hmm. developing countries. And would I be interested in making proposals to go and help these people get started with computer applications? So I did,
mm-hmm.
and I did.
And
so I went to a bunch of African countries, mm-hmm. and China once.
Mm-hmm. And is this a part of a travel inclination, or is that
I love to travel?
Okay.
Yes.
So.
Which is partly why I thought mining would be a good career, because I could travel.
Mm-hmm. And so, mm-hmm. have you done consulting in other countries, or do you just like to take a big long trip sometimes?
Well, most of my travel has been doing consulting work in other countries.
Yeah.
In the past few years, I've started just taking trips.
Uh-huh. So South America, Canada?
My husband and I went to Scotland last fall.
Mm-hmm.
And several years ago, I went on a trip. Well, actually, no. In about 1998, mm-hmm. I went on a trip with some Gibbs family, mm-hmm. and we had a Gibbs family tour of southern England, because that's where the Gibbses originally came from.
Mm-hmm.
And so I met a guy there named George Gibbs, and he was having an 80th birthday a few years ago, so I said, I'm going to go to his 80th birthday party.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, that's great.
Before that, I didn't have the money to do that.
Yeah.
So most of my trips were paid for by somebody else.
Right, right.
Which is great. I mean, it's a great way to travel.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
When were you in China?
It was probably early 90s.
Yeah. And so you were doing basically kind of database consulting?
No, it was, again, computer application training.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, because they were using computers pretty well then.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I did some geostatistics work with them, mm-hmm. and I took along a lot of public domain software,
right.
open source. We call it open source now, but it was public domain.
Right.
And because they were interested in developing some things, but they have such a huge country that they can't afford to buy 1,000 data mines.
Right.
So they wanted to know what the technology was and, what these programs could do so that they could develop it themselves.
Right. And also you went to Kenya, is that right? Kenya?
No, it was Malawi.
Okay.
Tanzania,
mm-hmm.
Ethiopia, and Ghana.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
And what years roughly were you doing that time?
That was mid-80s to mid-90s.
Mm-hmm.
I loved it.
I bet.
It was great.
Yeah. Yeah. What were some of the most fascinating aspects of that consulting work?
Well, the African people are different.
Yeah.
Because and I realized this because I was doing some training. You know, some of it was just basic. This is how you use a PC.
Yeah.
And you know, it didn't take me too long to realize that, you know, in their cultures, they learn things by rote.
Mm.
Because they don't have very many books. They don't, you know, they paper is a valuable commodity.
Yeah.
So and I saw this in several places where I was. The teacher would say blah blah blah. The students would say blah blah blah.
Right.
So they learned a lot of things by rote, mm-hmm. and I realized that, you know, some of why they couldn't understand certain concepts about how to use a computer was that they didn't really understand a variable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things had to be, you know, if you want to find a document that's xyz.doc, then you look for xyz.doc. Mm-hmm. You don't look for, and they didn't quite get that you could use an asterisk for the xyz part.
Right, right.
So that was a very interesting revelation for
mm-hmm,
me.
Mm-hmm. And so you had to key or to make changes in your pedagogy in order to,
yeah.
to reach them a bit better.
Yeah,
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So that was a challenge.
And you've had service to the mining associations as well. So you received the SME Distinguished Service Award. When was that?
Well, that must have been in the 90s mm-hmm. sometime. And that was because of all of the work that I had done on making the industry more aware of the capabilities of computing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's what that was about.
Great. So you were recognized for that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I didn't seek it out. It's just,
right.
you know, this guy did it,
mm-hmm.
you know.
But you were a member of SME?
I've been a member of SME for over 50 years.
Yeah.
Because I started in 1960 when I was a student.
Mm-hmm.
They consider that, and I stayed a member the whole time.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, that's amazing.
It is.
Totally amazing.
It is.
It's like, how did that happen?
Right. And one of the other important associations is the Mining and Metallurgical Society of America.
Right.
And you're executive director since?
Since 2008.
Since 2008.
And how did that happen? Mm-hmm. Well, that's another interesting story. I think I was invited to join in 1993. Mm-hmm. So I became a member of MMSA in 1993. And I happened to go to one of the annual meetings one time, because we do our annual meetings during SME.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to the annual meeting one time, and they were talking about website. And I had been doing website work for Mineral Information Institute,
mm.
so I kind of stuck my head in and, you know, spoke up and said, oh, I can help with that. So I was doing that for, I don't even remember what years, but anyway, I was doing that for some years, and then the executive director, and then I would say, because I said, well, you know, I really ought to sit in on the executive committee meetings so that I get an idea of what's going on,
right.
so that I can, you know, do the right kind of thing for the web page. So when the previous executive director retired, then they asked me if I would do it, mm. because I was already kind of clued in to
yeah.
how things worked.
Right, you know? Exactly.
And I'm still learning.
That's right. It seems to be the societies seem to be an important social and I guess cultural glue for the industries. That brings people together. It allows
yeah.
people to network, and
right.
and it seems to be a pretty tight community.
It is.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I want to thank you for taking the time. We're running out of time here, unfortunately.
Oh, I'm sure. But I've been babbling on.
No, this has been really, really fascinating, and we don't have the story yet about, there's, I think, more to be done on the history of computing. Mm-hmm. And
I'd be glad to help, however.
That would be great. That would be great. Yeah. Well, we'll talk more. And thank you very much for sitting down to talk with the Oral History Center.
Yeah, thank you.